AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich, and with a bonus post-Oscar episode for you. We usually take a little bit of time off after the Oscars, but this year we had the opportunity to get a glimpse behind the scenes of the show that we really hadn't had before, so we decided to share it with you. Richard and I got on the line so early the morning after the Oscars to talk to Louis Fertel, who is a comedy writer, a writer for Jimmy Kimmel Live, and for the second year, a writer for the Oscars. And lest you be worried, it's a dream come true for Louis also. He says he wants to be Bruce Valanche, and now he really is. He is an Oscar nerd, just like the rest of us, and talked about what it's like to be behind the scenes of that, to get lost in the hallways of the Dolby and run into Arnold Schwarzenegger. He had a little bit of a role in helping pick which presenters in the acting categories would talk to which actors, which we were very jealous of. And he just had some great insight in how they put together this show, how they decide which jokes work, how John Cena wound up being the guy who was naked on stage. We had a great time talking to him. I think we're going to have Louis on again to just talk about some random old Oscar movies because he has that knowledge. So until we come back next week with more of our regularly scheduled episodes, please enjoy this conversation with Louis Fertel. So, Louis Fertel, thank you so much for coming to talk to me and Richard. I just need everyone to know that we're recording at 7:30 a.m. Pacific time, the morning after the Oscars. You were at the Oscars, and yet you're here talking to us. So, thank you, and I'm sorry.
I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't put a finger on it.
When you agreed to this time, I was like, Jesus.
But you know what? Again, they record the Oscars early now, so like you can even go to the after party and then be done by like 8:15. So, actually, it wasn't that daunting.
Well, and also you told us that for Kimmel, for the Jimmy Kimmel Show, which you do work for when you're not writing for the Oscars, you have a show tonight. You had jokes too. So really the show literally goes on even the day after the Oscars, right?
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, usually we start writing jokes at 7 a.m. and they're due at 8:50 a.m. But they just let us know they pushed it back 2 hours today. So
wow.
People get to be sane and write even more Oscars jokes for today's show.
So we are, we follow the Oscars year round, but we don't really get your side of things very often at all, which is why this is fun. So just to ask the kind of easy question, like when you are writing for the Oscars, when does the work start? How do you begin? And what is that process like?
For us, it actually begins before the new year. So when Jimmy like announced he was doing the show again, and then right afterwards, basically, we started getting assignments, most of which were moot within a period of weeks. Not only did we have the assignment to write about Saltburn, we needed to write more about Saltburn eventually. just things that didn't come up in the ceremony at all. But it's nice to start that early because, you know, I'm obsessed with movies like you guys, but not everybody has like a built-in sensibility about whatever, the work of Christopher Nolan or Greta Gerwig or whatever. So you sort of gain the understanding you'll need to be making jokes about these people for months at a time.
Are you considered among the staff of people writing for this, like kind of the ringer? Because if people aren't familiar, you have what could only be called an encyclopedic knowledge of the Oscars. So I'm wondering,
I would describe it as a condition. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You've been studied by doctors. But I mean, are you sort of turned to for a certain kind of Oscar-y joke, or how does that kind of play out?
I have the same assignments as everybody else, but yes, I make myself known is all I can say. I am deeply, deeply, deeply obsessed with the Oscars. I'm on a thread of people, most of whom you know, Richard. We watch old Oscar-nominated movies all the time. I'm on a thread of people who are just like, oh, I haven't seen that Teresa Wright movie, or I haven't seen that Paulette Goddard movie, or whatever. So I'm not just one layer deep. I'm about seven, and I'm writing with people who are, you know, concerned just with this year's movies. So once we get to the point in the room with Jimmy where we're finessing jokes or putting the monologue together, he'll ask something, like 2 days ago, when he was at the Dolby rehearsing, he just said, he goes, did Cynthia Erivo ever win anything? I'm like, no, she was nominated for actress and song. So to be on basically a slightly faster Wikipedia is what I serve as sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, something we talk about all the time is the tension of the Oscars between appealing to people who maybe only saw Saltburn last year or only saw Barbie as a better example, and people like us who know who Teresa Wright is and what Cynthia Erivo has been nominated for. How does that work for you guys in the jokes that you're writing? What's your kind of acid test to figure out what's going to split the difference? Because I think the jokes this year really did. It didn't make anyone feel like they were insulted for having paid attention to movies, but also made people feel welcome. How do you do that?
Well, there are so many writers, and you're so invited to pitch whatever, that there's no restraints, really. Like, if you want to go back and pitch a really historical joke, there's a place for that, potentially. Because by the end of it, we have all this material. I think Jimmy, in our CBS This Morning segment, estimated there are 5,000 jokes by the time we actually get to the final whittling. One of our head writers is nicknamed The Whittler. There's a reason to pitch everything. He wants variety so that he can pitch something sort of weave something interesting together ultimately. But I think it's wiser if you spend more of your time just pitching to what are the nuts and the bolts of the monologue going to be. Like, you have to say something about the year Greta Gerwig had. You have to say something about the fact that Sandra Hüller is in two Best Picture nominees, you know? So I think there's a place for, look what I found on Wikipedia, and, you know, it will inevitably take a long time to explain and understand for the audience, you know? So it's like the economy of, we all are already talking about these certain subjects, sticking to those is probably wiser.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of mandate from the network or from the Academy itself? Like, are there parameters set before you, or is it the thinking that because Kimmel's done this, you know, a few years now, that you guys kind of know what you're doing?
Yeah, this is only my second Oscars, but most of the people who write for Kimmel have worked for him for 150 years, and they've done it even longer and have written for various other award shows he's hosted. I wrote for the Emmys when he did that a few years ago, too. No, we never hear anything, like anything in the world of blowback or don't address this certain thing. Like, he is pretty, like, Yale level when it comes to how deep the monologue can get in terms of denseness of material for a general audience. Like, I think he really handles that well, modulates that well. And I can't think of anything he wanted to talk about that we then did an about face from, even. Like, I think he was pretty clear on the topics he wanted to address. Like, the way it ended, we had several rounds on the strikes and quote unquote what we learned from the strikes. Mm-hmm. And we kept missing. He didn't agree on what we learned, I think, a few times. But eventually, he found what he liked, and we addressed that, too. So that's sort of as, like, I think something in that area might be something higher-ups could have potentially objected to, but they didn't.
I thought the way that the monologue addressed the strikes was so powerful and really set things off on a good note. It was really the first award show we've had since the strikes ended that did anything about the strikes and having all the crew come on stage. How did you guys realize that was the note to strike and to end the monologue on?
You know what? I kind of didn't. We had pitched to it, and, you know, you become anesthetized to the subject after a while, after writing joke after joke after joke about it. You forget to even think of the visual element of, oh, here is the crew that the audience will be seeing. Watching it, I was like, oh, wait, that was amazing. Like, I kind of didn't know until the end. Like, I thought the big joke was going to be, look at the dog from Anatomy of a Fall. He's in the audience, you know.
Where are you during the show?
I am right off stage, as in when I'm Just Ken is happening, there's a pink glow over us because we are underneath the stage design.
Yeah. So do people walk past you and watch the accountants juggle the envelopes and all that stuff? Do you have like the backstage view of everything?
Yes. last year I collided basically with Danai Gurira, who is, shall we say, a commanding presence. I felt immediately bad about that. And then this year, just when you go to the bathroom and back, first of all, I have no sense of direction. Nothing is intuitive to me, not once ever, especially at the Dolby. I am constantly getting lost back there. Everything is labyrinthine. And I was going back to where all the writers are, and I was urged to stop. A stranger, I hope he worked for the Academy, told me to stop. And I realized I was walking into the shot where Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger did something backstage before they came on stage. And that made no logical sense to me. I had no idea why I had arrived where I had arrived. It's like it's like a dream state. Like, first of all, there's the Oscars backstage. And then because it's at the Dolby, it's at this mall complex. So you're constantly like running into hallways that have no glamour component. Like, you kind of are looking into the window of a Lids store sometimes. So it's like all these worlds are colliding as you're just trying to like think of jokes about whomever, Davine Joy Randolph.
And then Arnold Schwarzenegger is there just to really add an extra
right, yes. So, there's some surreal there, yeah.
I spent 2 days backstage at the Dolby when I was writing a feature about American Idol, the end of American Idol, well, the first end of it. And it really is the weirdest space because it just seems like room upon room upon room. There's something sort of surreal about it. But I'm wondering about that sort of behind the scenes glimpse that you've now gotten twice. Like, has working at the Chocolate Factory changed your view of the Oscars?
No. First of all, because there's so many writers and so many points of view, I think we're all clear that if any one of us weren't a part of it, it would still go on as planned. It would still be like, it's not like I've gotten too close to the sun or something like that. I guess what changes is, even just doing it for 2 years now, like you start to recognize there are certain beats and certain sensibilities you have to hit when addressing the audience, addressing the movies. And like, you know, I come from the world of Twitter, where during the ceremony, I would prefer to be making, I guess not snarky jokes, but like hard and authentic jokes to me, which as a moviegoer or as, you know, an insane gay moviegoer, history buff fan, would probably be a little bit more cutting than the average joke you write for Jimmy Kimmel, for example. And I do get a part of me is a little saucy about not getting to express that all the time. But at the same time, it's always been my dream to write something like this for the Oscars. Like, I want to be Bruce Valanche. I want to be him. So to get to do that is a nice trade-off.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I feel like when you're writing jokes for in the audience, there's so much reliant on how the people themselves react. You're making jokes in front of them, which is now what most people are doing. And reaction shots this year were really great. Like, I thought, like, Steven Spielberg really nailed every single one of his moments. Michael Keaton in that same Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito bit did a great job. How much can you guys account for that, write for that? How does that process work?
Let me tell you something. In terms of writing just for Kimmel on a day-to-day basis, how the audience will react is something is not my strong suit. Like, I am rarely correct. Meanwhile, Jimmy is like a virtuoso of that. He knows, he's like, oh, I'm going to get a groan here that will last literally 3 seconds. Like, he knows, like, sonically how it will sound. But for example, I wrote the Sandra Hüller joke about, she was in Anatomy of a Fall about killing your husband. She was in this movie playing a Nazi wife. And, you know, These are heavy topics for Americans, but in Germany, those are considered rom-coms.
Yeah.
He knew she would react with that sour, my German mom TikTok sort of reaction. And I kind of didn't know. And also, I don't even have a sense of how well they can hear the monologue. Like, sonically in the Dolby, I don't really know what's going on. But, like, her reaction was amazing. I was like, this is why I do this, you reacting like that. Steven Spielberg held that moment. He had such good comic timing when he was doing that thing with America Ferrera and
Kate McKinnon. Yeah.
Kate McKinnon. Yes. That was lovely to see.
Now, is your team writing not just the monologue, the Kimmel stuff? Are you also writing presenter patter, or how does that work? What is that division of labor?
It actually surprises me what we write and don't write. We get prompts to write for presenters, generally speaking, if there's an extended comedic element to it. Anything where it's just sincere, like we didn't write the actresses presenting to actresses, for example. And right. I in a way, like, I'm happy somebody else handles that, but poetically, I do want to write like a letter from Mary Steenburgen to Emily Blunt. Like, I just want to do that as a writing exercise.
You already have it written. You just wanted it to be read.
Yeah. It's a sonnet the way I did it. But we do get prompts. Like we did some ideas for Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer. I actually do not know if they ultimately went with something we pitched or if it's something they did. Cause Melissa comes from improv. It wouldn't surprise me if she wrote her whole thing herself. But not all the presenters we give something to. And I want to say, like, John Mulaney wrote his own thing, for example.
Yeah, right. That Field of Dreams thing feels like it'd be hard to sell if it didn't come directly from his own brain.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would love to pitch that line for line, but yeah, it does feel very him.
Yeah. I mean, this year's show came in shorter than what the average has been lately, even though they did those, you know, Mary Steenburgen presents Emily Blunt moments, which, you know, I think the Oscar nerds among us really love. What kind of timeline do you guys ever have in mind? Do you ever get that sense of like, oh, God, we got to wrap it up so that the 11 o'clock news can come on? Or are you immune from that?
Oh, no, we absolutely, we hear about that constantly. So Molly McNierney, who's our head writer, executive producer of the Oscars and Kimmel and Jimmy's wife, she was talking constantly about how we will definitely run over. And I believe that, given the all those presenters, the musical numbers. I guess where we saved time was the number of presenters, because people tended to do multiple awards, which is not usually the case in Oscar history, I guess. But I don't understand how that happened. I literally don't get it. Like, I thought everything was, like, the monologue wasn't particularly short. You know, Jimmy's, we did have the John Cena bit. We had, but otherwise we didn't have any really large scale bits. So maybe that's where we saved time.
The tequila bit was the only other lengthy-ish one.
Which was like a minute, right?
Yeah.
So, but I guess the speeches were generally speaking short, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like at this point in awards history, we have hammered home, like, it's just better to have a shorter speech. Like, people tend to, one, remember you better if there's a shorter speech. And two, like, nobody wants to hear the band playing people off. Like, we don't love the awkwardness. And I think people just agree with that now.
I mean, yeah, I mean, Melissa Leo is still giving her speech. But other than that,
we have to ask her to get off the stage while we moved into the Dolby.
Yeah. She comes back on during commercial breaks.
Right.
Keeps talking. Were there any
muttering about Treme? Stop it. Yeah,
exactly. Speaking of that whittling, like, were there any darlings that unfortunately were killed?
Yes. And the thing is, like, I pitch hundreds of jokes. I give him a wonderful bouquet of jokes every day. And I say, pick from this nosegay what you love. But it doesn't bother me that he doesn't pick every single one of them until the end, when we see a version of the final script that will inevitably be chopped up hours before the ceremony. And so you're praying your last few jokes are still in the running. I had one about Lily Gladstone that got cut right before the end, which was, oh, your performance in Killers of the Flower Moon was so moving. This is the only movie to make me want to stand up and yell at the screen, do something, President Coolidge. the oomph he could have given it. But,
so the Coolidge jokes and the Teresa Wright jokes again, maybe.
I know. I don't feel seen. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
And the producers could have cut to Jennifer Coolidge in the audience. I mean, it really would have been.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Rita Coolidge. Yes. Could have sung her Bond theme. It would have been great. Yeah.
You mentioned the John Cena bit. What can you tell us about the, you know, putting together that really the most elaborate and kind of riskiest bit of the entire night, I think, like someone showing up naked on stage to present Poor Things with Best Costume Design, like could have really struck a wrong tone, but I think it really worked. How did you guys pull that off?
I don't know. I think it was our writer, Greg Martin, and another writer of ours, a Twitter veteran, Jesse McLaren, who originated the idea of that. But it was really hard nailing down who to give that bit to, because you wanted it to straddle all these worlds where it's like somebody who would be naked somewhat organically, someone who had an adjacent to prestige quality, somebody who would have a rapport with Jimmy, and somebody who just belonged at the Oscars. And so I think a bunch of names were sort of circled, but I just watched our CBS This Morning bit with Ted Koppel, who is still around and quite snarky, I just want to say.
Wow.
And we did not have that guy, even though the bit was written, until like the last week. I want to say maybe Jimmy even had to reach out to John Cena, but he is exactly correct because, one, he's in Barbie. So he's got the best picture, belongs at the Oscars quality. Two, but he's not like a super serious actor. And also he is a comic actor, but not so obvious that seeing him in this bit would feel like, you know, an obvious bit. So he really hit all the chakras of the bit in a way that is extremely satisfying. I'm so glad it ended up being him.
Yeah.
And then you had the fortuitous, you know, synergy of Poor Things, a movie that also there's a lot of nudity and like it all just sort of ended up working out for the best.
Right. Also, I just want to say, like, I guess that's the only real surprise of the evening is Poor Things taking home more awards than expected.
Yeah.
I wish we had a more kind of kaboom surprise, but that's so kaboom surprises are downright rare in modern Oscars telecasts. I almost wonder if we're past that era.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all, a lot of us predicted Lily Gladstone would win Best Actress. So I think that was really the closest thing for us, which, you know, Richard and I, after we talked to you, we're going to do our immediate rehash with our co-hosts and figuring out all the things we got wrong. But I feel like that was probably the biggest one.
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of the surprise factor, the problem is there are all these fucking podcasts that like talk about the awards season for months
yes.
and they kind of ruin it. And I wish they would stop.
Hate those girls and their voices.
Yes. Exactly.
So,
and their queer voices.
What for you, like, will be the most memorable thing about this ceremony as a viewer or as a writer for the show?
I mean, I'm so egotistical that for me, the most memorable thing is just being there and calming myself down, not knowing what will make it to air and what will get a reaction. So there's just a, I imagine writing for SNL is sort of similar where you have an idea that things will be successful, that, you know, your sensibility will come across and people will respond to it. But there's also a world in which every joke dies or a bit doesn't go off or somebody quits a bit at the last moment or something. So just the general stress of being there, married with the fact that I don't know where else on earth I would rather be. Like, it's both the place I have so many feelings and I get preoccupied with the negative ones, even though this is my dream. So just that mix of strange feelings is a lot of fun, ultimately.
So what do you do when the show is over? We know you're up very early, so you're not out super late, but do you get like a moment or two to breathe before it's right back to work?
Yes. Well, right after the show, we spent like an hour in a hallway waiting to go to the governor's ball. I don't know if Jimmy was getting dressed or what, but it gets hot in these ancient Dolby hallways and I don't drink and everybody's like sitting around with champagne. So I actually was getting frustrated. That's what happens to me after the ceremony. But then you go up to the governor's ball, which is right over the Oscars. And this time, like you see like Cord Jefferson with his Oscar and stuff. And you know what I will miss now? Cause I'm realizing in this moment, it won't always be this way. Wherever I turn at the Dolby, like in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the way Slugworth appears at every corridor, you always see Diane Warren. She is everywhere with like a cane. You know, she's dressed like fancy Snoopy always.
She had those fire lapels this year,
right.
Her on-theme lapels.
And like a few years ago, I worked for the Academy. I was their correspondent on the red carpet. They did like a live telecast on Twitter, I think. And I did that in 2019, 2020. And then I wrote for the Oscars last year and this year. And Diane has been there every single time. And sometimes she's playing on stage and sometimes she's just, you know, around, you know, like haunting the place. And the thing is, she's a nominee like any other nominee. And so there will come a time when Diane Warren won't be around or like, you know, isn't nominated or something. And there's just something so awesome about her being there. I don't know. It's like there's no comparison in Oscar history.
And, for someone who's just nominated every single year and yes, continues not right. winning and keeps coming back. Yeah.
I actually had the thought, what if Billie Eilish is like Diane Warren, except she can't stop winning? Wouldn't that be nice to have like a parallel path?
She has 15 Oscars.
She's like, I hate this. This is my prison. Yeah.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs. Well, before we let you go, Lewis, I want to ask, you're nominated, you're sitting in the audience, the five past supporting actress winners walk out. Who do you want to give your tribute?
And it has to be a supporting actor winner, which, as you know,
no,
is
it can be anybody, I guess.
Yeah, come on. We'll change the rules.
But interesting. Who would I want to give it to? Well, my favorite winner in Oscar history is Sandy Dennis for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Now, she is long dead, but... The combination of movie star presence and also insect-like appearance, I just think she's so unsettling. I miss when stars were haunting. You know, I miss stars like Bela Lugosi, you know, who just like look you in the eye and something is wrong. I love that.
So you want Christoph Waltz making Ken puns at you is what it yes. sounds like you're saying.
When we were, Molly was sort of consulting with me for who to pair for those things. And
oh my God, what a dream. Holy crap.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And when it ended up being Christoph Waltz on Ryan Gosling, I, you know, was askance at that for a second. And then I loved it.
Yeah.
Like then I was like, what a weird pairing. And I know there's something about him. I interviewed Christoph Waltz years ago. He's so German in the way where he's very literal and words, like everything about him is like he's talking as if he is a spider. You know, just like, and I felt like him using that voice to talk to Ryan Gosling would be so bizarre. And it was. I was so psyched it worked out that way.
It had just the right hint of menace. Yeah.
Yeah. It made me like contemplate him being in Barbie. Like it just seemed possible for a second there, which I never would have imagined. It was really great.
Well, yes, he owns exactly. the German version of Mattel. So that's probably what you're thinking.
I'm going to say quickly, in terms of somebody to present to me who is alive, Cate Blanchett. I just think when Cate Blanchett's at the Oscars, yeah. like all is right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And she can definitely pull off something like unsettling and slightly menacing, just depending on her delivery, because she can do anything.
Oh, I saw that Indiana Jones movie. I know she can do it. Yeah.
That does it for today's episode. As I said, we'll be back next week. We're looking toward the 2025 Oscars with our friend Joe Reed returning to join us. Find us in the meantime at Vanity Fair, on social media at VF Awards Insider, and you can find me at Katie Rich. Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.